Chapter 14. The top arc of the sun was falling below the horizon, and dusk was only minutes away. The winds had fallen from a violent to a brisk breeze from the east, caressing and darkening the sea. The tension that had been building up among the crew when they learned that all communication had been lost with Pisces seemed to spill over Sea Sprite like a black cloud. The fear that harm had come to Dirk and Summer nagged at their minds. Only one seriously damaged, rigid hull inflatable boat had survived the hurricane. The other three, usually carried by Sea Sprite, had been swept away by massive seas. During the high-speed run back to the original anchorage site off Navidad Bank, the boat was repaired just enough to carry three divers. Pitt, Giordino, and Cristiano Lelassi, a master diver and equipment engineer from Italy who was aboard Sprite testing a new robotic vehicle, would conduct the search and rescue operation. The three men were gathered in the ship's conference room along with most of the crew and concerned scientists. They listened intently as Barnum described the underwater geology to Pitt and Giordino. He paused to glance at a big 24-hour clock on one bulkhead. We should be on site in another hour. Since there has been no radio contact, said Giordino, we must proceed under the belief that Pisces was damaged in the hurricane. And if Dirk's theory is correct, there is every reason to believe gigantic waves may have carried the habitat away from her last known position. Pitt took over. When we arrive at the habitat's position and it's gone, we'll launch our search using the grids programmed into our GPS computers. We'll fan out with me in the middle, Al on my right, and Cristiano to my left, and comb the bank toward the east. Why east? Asked Lelassi. The direction the storm was moving when it struck Navidad Bank, answered Pitt. I'll bring Sprite as close as I dare to the reef, advised Barnum. I won't anchor, so I can move swiftly if the need arises. As soon as you spot the habitat and assess the situation, report her condition. Are there any questions? Pitt asked Lelassi. The burly Italian shook his head. Everyone looked at Pitt with deep compassion in their eyes and hearts. This was not a search for strangers. Dirk and Summer had been their shipmates for the past 2 months and were regarded as much more than simply passing acquaintances or temporary friends. They were all allied in a quest to study and protect the sea. None dared entertain the thought that the brother and sister might have been lost. Then let's get started, said Pitt, adding, God bless you all for your support. Pitt wanted one thing and one thing only, to find his son and daughter alive and unharmed. Though he had not known they existed the first 22 years of their lives, he had nourished a love that had mushroomed in the short time since they had shown up on his doorstep. His only regret, and a deep one, was that he was not present during their childhood. He was also deeply saddened he had not known their mother had been alive those many years. The only other person in the world who had come to love the children as much as Pitt was Giordino. He was like a loving uncle to them, a sounding board and a hardy plank for them to lean on when their father proved stubborn or overly protective. The dive team filed out and made their way to the boarding ladder ramp that hung over the hull into the water. A crewman had lowered the battered, rigid hull inflatable boat into the water and set the twin outboard motors popping away at idle. Pitt and Giordino pulled on full wetsuits this time, with reinforced padding at the knees, elbows, and shoulders for protection against the sharp coral. They also decided to use air tanks instead of the rebreathing apparatus. Their full face masks were settled over their heads and a check made of their communication phones. Then, carrying their fins in one hand, they descended the ramp and climbed into the boat with their gear. As they boarded, the crewman jumped out and held the boat firmly against the ramp. Pitt stood at the console, took the wheel, and eased the twin throttles forward as soon as the crewman cast off the lines. Pitt had programmed Pisces' last known coordinates into his global positioning system instrument and set a direct course for the site less than a quarter of a mile away. Anxious to get there and almost afraid of what he might find, Pitt leaned on the throttles, sending the little boat whipping over the waves at nearly 40 knots. When the GPS numbers indicated he was getting close, he slowed and approached their target with the motors idling. We should be on it, he announced. Almost before the words were out of his mouth, Lelassi slipped over the side with a small splash and disappeared. In 3 minutes, he was back on the surface. Gripping a hand rope on the gunwale, he hoisted himself into the boat, air tanks and all, with one hand and rolled onto the bottom. Giordino surveyed the feat with amused interest. I wonder if I can still do that. I know I can't, said Pitt. Then he knelt beside Leilasi, who shook his head and spoke through his headphone. Sorry, signore, he spoke in accented Italian. The habitat is gone. I saw nothing but a few scattered tanks and some small debris. No way of telling their exact position, said Giordino soberly. Giant waves could have carried them more than a mile. Then we follow, Cristiano said hopefully. You were right, Signore Pitt. The coral appears crushed and broken in a trail toward the east. To save time, we'll search from the surface. Stick your heads over the sides. Al, you take the starboard. Cristiano, the port. Guide me by voice and point toward the trail of broken coral. I'll steer by your directions. Hanging over the rounded hull of the inflatable, Giordino and Leilasi peered through their face masks into the water and traced the path of the storm-swept habitat. Pitt steered as if in a trance. Subconsciously, he aimed the bow toward the course pointed out by Giordino and Leilasi. Consciously, his mind wandered over the past 2 years since his son and daughter had entered his adventurous but sometimes lonely existence. He recalled the moment he met their mother in the venerable old Ala Moana Hotel on Waikiki Beach. He had been seated in the cocktail lounge in conversation with Admiral Sandecker's daughter when she appeared like a vision, her long, flaming red hair cascading down her back. Her perfect body was encased in a tight, silk-green Chinese-style dress split up the legs on the sides. The contrast was breathtaking. A solid bachelor who never believed in love at first sight, he knew in an instant that he was ready to die for love. Sadly, he thought she had drowned when her father's underwater dwelling off the north shore of Hawaii collapsed in an earthquake. She swam to the surface with him, but then, before he could stop her, she returned beneath the sea in an attempt to rescue her father. He never saw her again. The smashed coral ends 50 feet dead ahead, Giordino yelled, lifting his head from the water. Have you spotted the habitat? Pitt demanded. There's no sign of it. Pitt refused to believe him. It couldn't have disappeared. It has to be there. In another minute, it was Leilasi's turn to shout. I have it! I have it! I see it too, said Giordino. It's fallen into a narrow canyon. Looks like it's lying at a depth of about 110 feet. Pitt turned off the ignition and shut the motors down. He nodded at Leilasi. Throw out a buoy to mark the position and mind the boat. Al and I are going down. Already geared up, all he needed to do was slip on his fins. He pulled them over his boots and went over the side without wasting another moment. He raised his feet and eased downward through a cloud of bubbles that burst with his entry into the water. The walls of the crevasse were so narrow he found it astonishing that the habitat had fallen to the bottom without becoming lodged against the narrow walls. The old familiar fingers of foreboding started clawing at his stomach until he stopped all movement for a moment and drew a deep breath to prepare himself for what he hoped he wouldn't find. But he couldn't shake the thought from his mind that he might arrive too late to save them. From above, as he approached, the habitat appeared to be intact. Not surprising, considering its substantial construction. Giordino arrived and motioned toward the damaged entry lock that was smashed and jammed against the coral. Pitt gestured that he saw it too. Then his breath stopped for an instant, and his heart increased its beat when he spied the badly damaged tanks that supplied air to the interior. Oh, God, no, he thought as he kicked down and swung around to face the big view portal. Please may they not have run out of air. Fearful that they were not in time, he pressed his face mask against the thick plastic, his eyes trying to penetrate the gloom inside. There was a weird half-light that filtered down through the crevasse from the surface, and it was like looking into a mist-shrouded cave. He could just make out Summer lying inert on blankets on the bottom side of the habitat. It looked to him as though Dirk was leaning against the upturned floor beside her, but propped on his elbows, leaning over her. Pitt's heart leaped when he saw Dirk move. He was in the act of passing an air regulator from his mouth to hers. Overjoyed at finding his children alive, he wrapped the hilt of his dive knife wildly against the viewport. The pressure gauge on the tank was in the red. The end was now only a few short minutes away. Summer and Dirk inhaled and exhaled slowly in measured breaths to stretch their diminishing air supply as long as they could. The water outside had turned from blue-green to a gray-green as the light from the setting sun faded. He glanced at his sub-300T orange-faced Doxa dive watch given to him by his father. 7:47 p.m. They had been alone in the habitat without communication from the outside world for nearly 16 hours. Summer lay in a semi-sleep. She only opened her eyes when it was her turn to take a few breaths from the tank through the regulator, while Dirk held his, absorbing every molecule of air in his lungs. She thought she saw a movement beyond the viewport. At first, her fogged mind thought it was merely a large fish, but then she heard a rapping sound on the hard, transparent surface. Abruptly, she sat up and stared over Dirk's shoulder. A diver was hovering outside. He pressed his face mask against the port and waved excitedly. Seconds later, he was joined by another diver who made happy, animated motions at finding life inside the habitat. Summer thought that she had entered a happy mood of twilight delirium, but then she became aware that the men she saw in the water were real. "Dirk," she cried. "They're here. They've found us." He turned and blinked in dazed relief. Then a wild realization set in as he recognized the two divers outside the port. "Oh my God, it's Dad and Uncle Al." They both placed their hands on the viewport and laughed in exhilaration as Pitt held his gloved hands in the same position outside. Then he took a slate from his belt and wrote two words before holding it up. "Your air?" Dirk frantically searched through the jumbled mess inside Pisces until he found a felt pen and a pad of paper. He wrote in large letters and pressed the pad against the port. 10, maybe 15 minutes left. "That's cutting it pretty fine," Giordino said over his headphone. "Damn fine," Pitt agreed. "No way we can break the viewport before their air runs out." Giordino spoke words that sickened him but had to be said. Nothing short of a missile could blast through the viewport. And even if it was possible, the water pressure at this depth would erupt into the habitat like dynamite exploding inside a pipe. The surge would crush them. Giordino never ceased to be amazed at Pitt's cold, calculating mind. Another man might have panicked at knowing his son and daughter had only minutes before dying an agonizing death. Not Pitt. He hung poised in the water as if he was contemplating the languid movements of a tropical fish. For several seconds, he seemed placid and unmotivated. When he spoke, it was in an even, distinct tone. "Paul, are you reading me?" "I hear and understand your dilemma. What can I do from this end?" "I assume your tool locker is equipped with a Morphon underwater bore." "Yes, I'm pretty sure we have one on board." "Have it ready at the ramp when we arrive and make sure the drill is fitted with its largest circular cutting bit." "Anything else?" "We could use an extra pair of air tanks with regulators." "All will be waiting when you arrive." Then Pitt wrote on his slate and held it up in front of the viewport. "Hang in. Back in 10 minutes. Then he and Giordino rose out of sight and vanished above. When Pitt and Giordino ascended to the surface and vanished from view, it was as though a rainstorm had fallen on a surprise birthday party out on a lawn. Their hopes had soared at seeing their father and his best friend, but with them gone, everything turned bleak again. "I wish they hadn't left," Summer said softly. "Not to worry. They know the score on our air. They'll be back before you know it." "How do you suppose they're going to get us out?" Summer wondered aloud. "If anybody can pull off a miracle, Dad and Al can." She looked at the needle on the air tank gauge. It was quivering agonizingly closer to the end. "They'd better do it quick," she murmured softly. Barnum had the spare tanks and the Morphon underwater drill waiting as Pitt rushed back to the ship. Expertly turning the speeding boat on a dime, Pitt brought the boat to an abrupt stop beside the ramp. "Thank you, Paul," he said. "I aim to please," Barnum replied with a tight smile. No sooner was the gear stowed on board when Pitt jammed the throttles forward and charged back to the buoy floating over Pisces. Lelassi threw out an anchor as Pitt and Giordino adjusted their full face masks and fell over backwards into the water. Pitt had not inflated his buoyancy compensator to obtain neutral buoyancy with the heavy 20-pound Morphon drill. He allowed its mass to drag him to the bottom in a little less than a minute, equalizing his ears as he descended. As soon as his feet were firmly planted in the sandy bottom of the crevasse, he pressed the circular cutting edge of the drill against the viewing port. Before he switched the drill to rotate, he peered inside. Summer looked like she was semi-conscious. Dirk waved feebly. Swiftly, Pitt laid aside the drill and wrote on his slate, "Will drill hole for air tanks. Stay clear of incoming torrent." With precious few minutes to spare, Pitt pushed the drill against the viewport and squeezed the trigger, hoping against hope the bit would penetrate the transparent material with nearly the tensile strength of steel. The whirring sound of the drill motor, magnified underwater, and the rasp of the bit as it attacked the viewport startled every fish within 100 yards and sent them darting throughout the reef. Pitt leaned against the drill and pushed with every muscle in his legs and arms. He was thankful when Giordino dug his knees into the sand, hunched beneath Pitt, and placed his hands on the forward cylindrical section of the drill, adding his strength to the effort. Minute crawled after minute as the two men leaned against the drill with all their might. They didn't talk to each other. They didn't have to. Each had read the other's mind for more than 40 years. They worked like a matched pair of draft horses. Pitt bordered on frantic when he could see no more movement within the habitat. The deeper into the viewport the pit bored, the faster it penetrated. At last, Pitt and Giordino felt it burst through. They instantly jerked the drill back. Almost before Pitt could switch it off, Giordino was shoving an air tank and a regulator through the 10-inch diameter round hole, helped by the water that forced it into the lower air pressure inside. Pitt wanted to shout for his kids to react, but they could not have heard him. He could see that Summer made no effort to move. He was starting to retrieve the drill to enlarge the hole enough to crawl through when Dirk weakly reached out for the regulator and clamped his teeth on the mouthpiece. 2 deep breaths and he became aroused to normalcy again. He immediately and gently eased the mouthpiece between Summer's lips. Pitt wanted to cheer in euphoria when he saw Summer's eyes flutter open and her chest began to rise and fall. Though the inrush of water was rapidly filling the interior of the habitat, they now had more than enough air to breathe. He and Giordino picked up the drill again and attacked the viewport in an effort to enlarge the hole big enough for the two inside to escape. There was no feverish effort this time. They took turns widening the opening until the circular cuts had grown into a 4-leaf clover broad enough for a body to slip through. "Paul," Pitt called on his headphone. "I'm listening," Barnum answered. "The hyperbaric chamber? Ready to receive them the minute they come on board." "At what depth and how long have they been down on Pisces?" "They've been pressurized at 60 feet for 3 days and 14 hours. Then they'll need at least 15 hours of decompression." "Whatever time it takes," said Barnum. "I have an expert on hyperbaric medicine on board. He'll compute their decompression time." Giordino signaled that he had finished drilling the final hole. The interior of the habitat was nearly filled with water now, the condensed air pressure restricting the flow. He reached in, took Summer by the hand, and pulled her outside. Dirk passed through one of the air tanks. Summer started to wrap her arms around it and inhale through the mouthpiece of the regulator. Then suddenly she waved her hands in a wait signal and disappeared back inside the habitat. She quickly reappeared, clutching her notebooks, computer disks, and the digital camera in a watertight plastic bag. Giordino took her by the arm and led her up to the surface. Dirk came next with the second spare tank. Pitt gave him a quick embrace before they ascended together toward the only remaining inflatable. No sooner was the brother and sister pulled safely into the boat than Cristiano pushed the throttles forward and sped off toward the research ship. Pitt and Giordino, saving a couple of minutes by not climbing aboard too, remained in the water and pushed themselves clear before being chopped by the spinning propellers. When Lelassi returned and picked them up, his son and daughter were already inside the hyperbaric chamber. The basis behind decompression illness, or what is known as the bends, is that under normal air pressure, the body respires most of its excess nitrogen. However, under increasing pressure as a diver descends, nitrogen increases in the bloodstream. As a diver ascends and the surrounding water pressure decreases, pure nitrogen bubbles form in the blood and eventually become too large to pass through tissue. In order for the bubbles to diffuse and pass through lung tissue, the diver must sit inside a chamber that very slowly decreases pressure while breathing 100% oxygen. Dirk and Summer passed the long hours inside the chamber reading and writing reports on their findings about the dying coral and the brown crud, as well as recording their impressions of the cavern with the ancient artifacts, all while being monitored by the hyperbaric physician. The stars glittered like diamonds, and the lights of the high-rise condominiums beamed as sea sprites sailed into Fort Lauderdale's Port Everglades, one of the busiest deep-water ports in the world. The research ship's deck lights blazed as she slowly sailed past a long line of luxury cruise ships loading passengers and supplies for a morning departure. Alerted by the Coast Guard, every ship in the harbor blew three blasts of their whistles and air horns in salute as Sprite passed on her way to the Numa dock facilities. Her epic rescue of the ocean wanderer and her 1,000 guests 48 hours earlier was worldwide news. Pitt dreaded the media reception that would be waiting at the dock. He leaned over the railing on the bow and watched the black water, streaked by flashes of light that sparkled white off the bow. He became aware of a figure beside him, and he turned and looked into the smiling face of his son. It never ceased to amaze him that it was like looking into a mirror of himself 25 years ago. "What do you think they'll do with her?" Dirk asked. Pitt's eyebrows raised. "Do with what?" "Pisces." The decision whether to salvage her or not rests with Admiral Sandecker. Getting a barge with a crane over the coral might prove impossible. And even if it could be done, pulling 65 tons of dead weight up through the narrow confines of the crevasse might prove cost prohibitive. Chances are the Admiral may simply write her off. "I wish I could have been there to see you and Al drag the lines tied to the hotel's mooring cables to Sea Sprite." Pitt smiled. "I doubt if either one of us would volunteer to attempt it again." It was Dirk's turn to smile. "I'd have to bet against you on that one." Pitt turned and leaned his back against the railing. "Are you and Summer fully recuperated?" "We passed our balance and comparative sensitivity tests with flying colors and have no sign of after effects." "Different symptoms can turn up days or weeks later. Better you and your sister take it easy for a while. In the meantime, if you're so anxious for something to do, I'll give you a chore." Dirk gave his dad a suspicious look.
"Like what?"
"I'll arrange a meeting with St. Julian Perlmutter. You two can work with him to come up with answers about those ancient artifacts you found on Navidad Bank.
We really need to go back and further investigate what we found in the cavern."
"That can also be arranged," Pitt assured him, "but all in good time. There's no deadline."
"And the brown crud that's killing the sea life around the bank?" Dirk persisted. "It can't be ignored."
"Another Numa expedition with a new crew and different research ship will be assembled to return and study the scourge." Dirk turned and looked across the port at the lights dancing on the water.
"I wish we had more time to spend together," he said wistfully.
"How about a fishing trip in the North Woods of Canada?" Pitt suggested.
"Sounds good to me."
"I'll work on Sandecker. After what we all achieved in the past few days, I don't think he'll deny us a little time off for pleasure." Giordino and Summer came and joined them at the railing, waving to the ships they passed that signaled their praise for a job well done. The Sprite rounded a bend and the Numa dock came into view. As Pitt feared, it was crowded with TV vans and reporters. Barnum eased the ship alongside the dock. The lines were thrown down and looped on the bollards. Then the boarding ramp was lowered. Admiral James Sandecker charged onto the ship like a fox chasing a chicken. He almost looked like a fox with his narrow features, flaming red hair, and Van Dyke beard. He was followed by the deputy director of Numa, Rudy Gunn, the administrative genius behind the agency. Barnum greeted the admiral as he stepped on board.
"Welcome aboard, Admiral. I didn't expect to see you."
Sandecker waved an arm airily over the dock, and a mob of newspeople beamed.
"I wouldn't have missed this for the world."
Then he vigorously shook Barnum's hand. "A magnificent job, Captain. All Numa is proud of you and your crew."
"It was a team effort," Barnum said humbly.
"Without the heroic transfer of the mooring cables by Pitt and Giordino, the ocean wanderer would have surely smashed onto the rocks." Sandecker spotted Pitt and Giordino and walked over to them.
"Well, he said testily. Another day, another dollar. You two never seem able to stay out of trouble. Pitt knew that was the finest compliment the Admiral would pay him. Let's just say that we were lucky to have been on a project off Puerto Rico when Heidi Lishernes called from our hurricane center in Key West and described the situation. Thank God you were able to fly to the scene in time to help avert a major tragedy, said Gunn. He was a short little man with thick horn-rimmed glasses, blessed with a friendly disposition, a man whom everyone immediately liked. Luck played a major role, Giordino said unpretentiously. Dirk and Summer approached and was greeted by Sandecker. You two seem fit after your ordeal. If Dad and Al hadn't gotten us out of Pisces when they did, said Summer, we wouldn't be standing here. Sandecker's smile seemed cynical, but his eyes were filled with pride. Yes, it seems that good deed doers' work never ends. Which brings me to a request, said Pitt. Request denied, replied Sandecker, reading his mind. You people can put in for a restful vacation as soon as you finish the next project. Giordino stared sullenly at the Admiral. You're an evil old man. Sandecker ignored the slur. Soon as you all get your things together, Rudy will drive you to the airport. I have a Pneuma jet waiting to fly you to Washington. It's pressurized, so Dirk and Summer shouldn't have any complications from their recent decompression. We'll all meet in my office at noon tomorrow. I hope you have beds on the airplane, because that's the only sleep we're going to get, Giordino came back. Are you flying with us, Admiral? Asked Summer. He grinned craftily. Me? No, I'll follow on another plane. He motioned toward the waiting reporters. Somebody has to sacrifice himself on the altar of the news media. Giordino pulled a cigar from his breast pocket that looked suspiciously like one of Sandecker's private brand. He gazed cagily at the Admiral as he lit the end. Make sure they spell our names right. Heidi Lishernes sat staring unseeing at the array of monitors showing a dying Hurricane Lizzie. After swinging southeast and causing havoc with ships traveling through the Caribbean, she slammed into the east coast of Nicaragua between Puerto Cabezas and Punta Gorda. Fortunately, her strength had dropped by half, and there were few inhabitants living along the coastline. Before Lizzie traveled 50 miles across the lowland swamps and into the foothills, she had sputtered and finally died, but not before 18 ships were lost with all hands and 3,000 people had been killed, with another 10,000 injured and homeless. She could only imagine how the death toll might have mushroomed if her forecasts and warnings hadn't been sent out soon after Lizzie was born. She was sitting there, slouched at her desk that was littered with photos, computer analysis reports, and a forest of paper coffee cups, when her husband Harley approached through the empty office that looked as though Lizzie had swept through it, leaving an absolute mess for the cleaning people. Heidi, he said as he gently placed his hand on her shoulder. She looked up through reddened eyes. Oh, Harley, I'm glad you came. Come along, old girl. You've done an extraordinary job. Now it's time to let me take you home. Wearily, thankfully, Heidi came to her feet and leaned on her husband as he walked her out of the paper-strewn offices of the Hurricane Center. At the door, she turned and took a last look, focusing on a large strip of paper pinned on one wall that someone had written on. The block lettering read, If you knew Lizzie like we know Lizzie, oh, 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 what a storm. She smiled to herself and switched off the lights, sending the big storm center room into darkness.